Good morning.
You campaigned for it, you fought for it, you voted for it, and now it has arrived. Change begins now.
Labour Party leader and now UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Because in what was a surprise to absolutely no one, it was a Labour win. And after 14 years of Conservative government, the Tories were out. And with that, Rishi Sunak resigned.
Following this result, I will step down as party leader, not immediately, but once the formal arrangements for selecting my successor are in place. It is important that after 14 years in government, the Conservative Party rebuilds, but also that it takes up its crucial role in opposition professionally and effectively.
With Clare, Andrew Pearce, consultant, editor and columnist with the Daily Mail.
It's an historic win for Labour. It's an extraordinary victory. The Conservative Party has been annihilated. I'm not surprised. They fought a useless, hopeless campaign. But what is significant in the Tory losses, David Cameron's old constituency, former Prime Minister, has gone. Liz Truss, the former Prime Minister, hugely, that's probably the most significant defeat of the evening. She's lost. Boris Johnson's old constituency has fallen, and so has Theresa May. So there you have four former Tory Prime Minister's constituencies have all disappeared in this landslide. The Liberal Democrats winning most of those seats, but it's a huge, huge victory for Sir Keir Starmer. That is the real result tonight. If you think since the Second World War, Clem Attlee won a general election, what was a Labour leader who won a general election. Then you go to Harold Wilson, Tony Blair. He's only the fourth Labour leader to win a general election since 2005. And it's the biggest win since Blair in 1997. So good luck to him. It's not, as you probably know, probably not the party I would tend to support, but the country wasn't listening to the Tory party anymore. They'd had 14 years in power, and frankly, they'd thrown away the last few.
And here on Radio 1, all through Thursday night and into Friday morning, election fever. Colm O'Mungon was in Belfast, Sarah McInerney in Dublin, and it was, though, pretty clear from the get-go that it was not going to be a night for the Tories. Sarah spoke to former Conservative MP and Attorney General Dominic Grieve.
I've always expected that the election was going to go very badly for the government. And on the evidence, the Conservative Party is going to be filleted. I think that's perfectly obvious. And actually, the figures of 131 seats, if that is what it pans out to, is probably slightly better than some of the expectation. But it still leaves the Conservative Party in a bad mess. And how it pulls itself out of it is going to be the critical issue of the next 3 or 4 years, because will it lurch to the right and seek to go off and try and get reform support? Or is it going to move back to the political centre, which in my view is the only place where you can be if you wish to form a government? This election is the direct consequence of a major governance failure by the Conservative Party, which I'm afraid is the direct consequence of Brexit and the behaviour of Boris Johnson.
And in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin emerged as the largest party with 7 seats, the same number it had going into the election. But this was the big upset.
Very strongly and very, very effectively. And no, we won't be taking seats in Westminster. That's, by the way, that's Jim Allister now taking that seat, Mary. That, if you can hear the
yes, we can. We can indeed hear the shouting and the cheering behind you. So that's North Antrim, and that, of course, the seat that has been held by Ian Paisley, and before that by his father.
A huge blow for the DUP. Also for Morning Ireland up in Belfast. Here's Audrey.
Mary, thank you. Yes, it's all pure sport, isn't it? With us here in our Belfast studio, Vincent Kearney, our Northern editor. It's all over here. There might be 6 seats, I think, left across the water to fill, but 18 out of 18 are done here. Sinn Féin are top of the heap. 7 seats, they held on to all 7. The DUP are on 5. They lost 3. The SDLP are on 2. Alliance on 1. Ulster Unionists are back in Westminster with 1 seat. The TUV are there for the first time with 1 seat. And the Independents have won as well. Alex Easton won in North Down. But Vincent, the big story, of course, is Ian Paisley losing his seat in North Antrim. What happened?
Absolutely. I think it's a combination of factors. Jim Allister, leader of the TUV, has been a very effective critic of the DUP in recent years. And I think they underestimated him, perhaps. And I think Ian Paisley himself. The suggestion is that he became a bit complacent about it. The family had held the seat for 54 years. Bill White, described it earlier, was treated as a family heirloom. And I think there was a sense that perhaps it was taken for granted that it was always going to be within the Paisley family. But no one saw this coming. The only person who was confident with this was clearly Jim Allister, who's been working very hard behind the scenes. Senior people within the DUP were very shocked at this as news started to filter through. An issue some people thought that perhaps they'd misheard what was happening. But then we heard that the DUP, Ulster Unionists and the Lance tally counters at that count all had Jim Allister ahead. And at that point, I can tell there was a real sense of shock amongst senior members of the DUP.
Incredible.
Reeling. Also with Audrey, Katie Hayward of Queen's University.
How do you explain the DUP's losses?
Yeah, well, I mean, fundamentally, unionism itself faces a real challenge post-Brexit. And I do think we have to put this in the context of post-Brexit, what's changed. And really, there's two things that they need to manage. One is making devolution work. So that is the alternative to Irish unification. And the other is, how do you manage Northern Ireland's unique arrangements post-Brexit that have been put in place by the protocol, now called the Windsor Framework? And the DUP originally, of course, they protested about the protocol, and what we saw at that time was trust in them from strong unionists increased when they were protesting and when they were staying out of the assembly. But they knew that couldn't be sustained, because as they did that, we saw rising expectations of Irish unification and frustration from the wider community in Northern Ireland. So what they did then, they had that deal in February, end of January, February, with the British government, Safeguarding the Union, it was called, and it was designed to try and do the two things at once. Mm-hmm. So basically, to enable them to go back into power sharing at the same time as saying that the Irish Sea border no longer existed. Now, they overclaimed.
And on the News at One yesterday, correspondent Laura Hogan talked to voters in Ballymena and that North Antrim seat.
I think Paisley's just maybe let people down a wee bit more and the grasp of the union, you know. He doesn't keep the union to the forefront, and that's what the ground unionist likes to hear.
What's your reaction to Ian Paisley Jr. losing his seat?
It's a disgrace. He's the best man that ever was.
I certainly knew that he would lose a lot of votes, but I didn't think it would go as far as that. But the DUP have only themselves to blame.
A shaken DUP. But what now for Sinn Féin? Claire put this to Deirdre Heenan, Professor of Social Policy at Ulster University.
So, Deirdre, what do you think Sinn Féin will do with this mandate?
Well, I think Sinn Féin are savvy enough to realise that Keir Starmer is actually the most unionist Labour Prime Minister in a generation. So they will be wanting to persuade him that people here are now wanting constitutional change. He has already said that he's not interested in a border poll, that it's a long way off. So they will be going back. I think really their focus will be, tell us what the conditions for a border poll now are, because it has been so vague. And they will be saying demographic changes are in our sights, and we've had demographic changes, that the conditions are beginning to be met, given that they're the strongest party in all these parliaments that we have set out. They are going to want a definitive answer from this new Labour government as to what will the conditions be. Tell us, because as it is at the moment, we are at the whim of a Secretary of State. They will be pushing hard, but it is important to say that Keir Starmer has history in Northern Ireland. He understands it in a way that many of his predecessors didn't. He has skin in the game. Throughout the campaign, he talked about his role in Northern Ireland, his role in the policing board, his belief in the Good Friday Agreement. So they will be pushing him to say, if you believe in the Good Friday Agreement, then you tell us what the conditions are for a border poll, because we believe we are edging closer to that area.
All right.
And Taoiseach Simon Harris sent his congratulations to the Labour Prime Minister and spoke outside government buildings.
In the Labour Party manifesto, the language towards Ireland was language of partnership and of co-guarantors of our shared peace. This morning, from Dublin, I want to send a message to London that I will match Keir Starmer's commitment and energy to our peace process and to our future potential in so many areas. I will work to make the Taoiseach Prime Minister relationship not only what it should be, but what it could be.
And yesterday afternoon, Labour's Keir Starmer became Prime Minister and in his speech vowed to deliver change to restore service and respect for politics and end the era of noisy performance. So, a Labour Party pushing for change, a chastened Conservative Party examining its conscience against the backdrop of the rise of the Reform Party. Its leader Nigel Farage was elected as an MP for the first time, and a good day too for the Liberal Democrats. On the News at One, Gavin put this to Professor John Curtis, one of the UK's best known pollsters.
I mean, we've seen big electoral changes here in the last generation in Ireland. Sure. Arguably, they're seeing a big one in France at the moment. But under first past the post, is this landslide just a one-off generational thing, or is British politics genuinely changing?
Well, the answer to that question might be yes and no. I mean, I think it's now difficult to remember that after the 2019 election, people said, oh, it would be absolutely impossible for the Labour Party to win an overall majority. The kind of lead they would need, given their electoral geography, means it's virtually impossible. Well, then we have Boris Johnson and Partygate and Liz Truss and the fiscal event, and that just utterly transformed the electoral scene.
And Brexit and COVID, yes.
Yeah, sure. But the two things, there are just literally two points in the last four and a half years when support for the Conservatives fell precipitously. And those are the two events. And they are the two events that eventually are the foundations of Conservatives' defeat. So to that extent, at least, we should not read too much from one election about what's going to happen in 5 years' time. Who knows what's going to happen in the next 5 years?
And earlier with Áine on Morning Ireland in London, Mark Paul, the Irish Times London correspondent. Because while Keir Starmer's campaign slogan was indeed change, he does face an uphill battle.
The thing I keep thinking about, John Byrne Murdoch, the Financial Times data analyst, and he, in September 2022, the poorest people in Ireland have a standard of living almost 63% higher than the poorest people in the UK. There's a lot wrong here and a lot that needs fixing. Keir Starmer talking about change, how's he going to do it?
Well, with great difficulty. I mean, there are parts of England that you go to, up in the northeast in particular, where you see, I mean, obviously Westminster is a bubble and London is a bubble within Britain, but you see standards of living that you just don't see in Ireland. You don't see anywhere else. And there actually wasn't a huge amount of talk about child poverty and poverty during the election campaign. There was a lot of talk about change. There was a lot of talk about taxes and immigration. But there are people who are left behind and have been for years in this country. And I think the ramifications of that are being played out in the vote. It's why reform, a lot of the people who are disaffected by immigration, in fact, those people are also affected by levels of poverty and by levels of disadvantage. And Nigel Farage and people like Reform come along and they point at people from abroad and they say that's the reason and why things haven't gone so well for you. But of course, it's for a whole host of reasons. Bad governance, neglect, and maybe now Keir Starmer has a chance with a majority of this size to put in place the sort of policies that Britain needs to bring these places back up. Boris Johnson promised it with levelling up, but he never delivered it.
From Morning Ireland. And with Claire, Philip Boucher-Hayes reporting from London. He brought us this.
I went to a food bank this morning, only in a cruel twist of fate to find out that it had been closed for the elections. And the woman who arrived just before me, I saw her crumple, bow her head and just turn and walk away. Now, she didn't want to talk to me, but this man did. And he is typical of nearly every single conversation that I have had here in London in the course of the last 2 days. Informed, angry about what is going on, but without faith that much is going to change now.
What do you think of that election result?
I didn't actually see it.
You're just waking up to the news now, are you? Okay, well, Labour won in a landslide.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge fan.
Why not?
I'm not a fan of any politician because they all promise things that they never deliver. I think Jeremy Corbyn was the closest thing we had to a real leader who could have taken the country in a slightly different direction. But everybody else for the last, well, since Thatcher or before Thatcher, has just been tearing this country to shreds. When you look at all of the options that we have, they're all the same.
A dispiriting note on which to end. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Wednesday night, sure 'twas better, for it too is back. And a favourite at this point, 20 Questions, Oscailge, Agus Béarla. And this from Terran Uair Ladies Club, 1974. See how you do.
Tashisha Anavia.
Human.
Yes.
A specific person?
No.
A characteristic?
Describes, yes.
An occupation?
No.
Give it a fucking thought.
Might be with some fellas.
Gawkan.
Would the ladies be very keen if this were a full-time job with every fella?
I let the ladies answer that themselves. Some say yes, some say no.
I'm stumped.
I'm having a rash, is what they were talking about.
How are they going to guess that?
That's so niche, isn't it? Really. But isn't it great the way a bit of smut goes a long way?
Oh,
you know,
oh, you are not wrong. Not wrong at all. And we're going to do that really annoying thing that we will give you the answer later in the programme. On Sunday Miscellany, the second programme themed around ways of seeing. This was recorded at the Belfast Book Festival at the Crescent Arts Centre. And this poem from Micheál McCann.
My partner and I entertained a brief psychotic episode where we thought we could buy a house together. And this poem emerged from that episode. Walking through empty houses. Receiving the customary chill passing Paisley's Church, a theological spank on the bottom, we are soon greeted as two brothers by the gilet-wound estate agent. He struggled to turn his BMW, cobalt and sleek, in the tiny cul-de-sac. A rider, is it? BMW asks if you're proud, and I wonder, does he mean our mother? Somewhere in Ballysillan seems promising. Then three articles unspool about three Catholic families prevented from moving in. Not too west, not too east. For the first time, I wish my name away. Packs of miserable people, a kettle of vultures awaiting Susie, the estate agent, to disembark her Micra. Poor Susie. Friendly, but without enough hunks of meat for all the jet black jackals with our red eyes. She unlocks the bright pink door, perfect for poofs, I say, you frown. And desperate people abandon small cars and umbrellas. We speak quietly as we step through a small terraced house, as though on consecrated ground, wherein we do not belong. Having endured the last what's for you well wish, I go catatonic in Boy Park. Simple are my requests. To cook eggs well on a stove I inherit, while looking out to a yard painted mint green, pebbles in terracotta pots from which nasturtiums erupt and crawl the walls, to lie in bed and watch a stippled ceiling, sounds of kids tumbling up and down the stairs next door, rather than paramilitaries kicking the other men out of the house beside, for the lock to be strong, the windows to be open, a front door to be painted a lively colour, to be undisturbed with my cat on a cheap upright, for those squares of sun on the rug to be mine.
From Sunday Miscellany. And yes, it is only July, but for students heading to college, thinking about where they can afford to live, it's an ongoing headache. On Monday, Oliver was joined by two students from Dunleary Institute of Art, Design and Technology, Nicola Byrne and Tig Nolan. They have a project, it's called 66 Voices. Students talking about their money worries, especially the cost of rent.
It's a grand a month for digs, like a box bedroom.
I was living in a construction site the first 3 or 4 months of college. So now I live in the attic together with my friend. It's €1,200 to share a bed.
It's present in every single moment and decision of mine. It's like a little demon in the corner of my room or something.
It's a stressful situation because I really want to be independent and not rely on like my parents, but it's a necessity at this point if I want to continue college. Like,
when people say they're paying this much to share a bed, do they mean share a bedroom?
No, that was one of the girls we spoke to, unfortunately. She'd been in digs and then
they were trying to like make her leave, and then she was like, please let me stay. So she ended up moving into the attic, and there was another girl in the same situation. She had been in digs in a different room in that house, and they ended up, like, the landlady was like, the only way you can stay is if you move into the attic. And she only had one bed for them, so they both shared the bed. I think eventually got a second bed, but still it was ridiculous rent even to be having your own bed.
That's insane.
They were sharing a bed and paying the same rent, like €1,200 to share a bed in an attic.
There are no words for that.
I know, though.
From Oliver on Monday. Now, if you have been hooked on the real Carrie Jade from the Doc on One team, you'll know that the last episode dropped this week. If you haven't caught up, get on it now. It's addictive. But there seems to be no limits to this woman's imagination or deception.
It turns out that while Sam is creative in her inventions, some, like the Grey's Anatomy character, are lifted from elsewhere.
I grew up as a kid on protest marches. And
take the story she told us about her mother bringing her on protest marches.
Some children got taken to, you know, SeaWorld in Florida. I got taken to stand outside to, like, protest poor Tillicum the whale. You know,
when that clip from our podcast was played on the RTE radio programme, Liveline, a church minister, William Hayes, recognised it immediately.
SeaWorld in Florida. I got taken to stand outside to, like, protest poor Tillicum the whale.
The really weird bit about that show is that that's actually the plot of a book called The Horizontal Epistle of Andromeda Veil. It's this kind of comedy writer called Adrian Plath who writes that. And some of those lines are straight out of Adrian Plath.
That minister had come across Sam several years ago when she had tried to become involved in his church in Offaly in the Irish Midlands. Last year, when Sam involved herself with the church community in Kildare, she was found out and left. But not before she had inserted herself into the life of one of the women in that church.
From the real Carrie Jade. But if that is not your bag, maybe you will enjoy Irish Imperial Lives, which started this week. It is about our relationship with the UK. Drop down menu, it's complicated.
There will be pirates, eyes will be lost. There will be revolts from enslaved peoples. There will be hostages.
There will be ostrich feathers,
eh? Yes, I shouldn't forget the ostrich feathers. Those are quite significant, you'll find out why.
Hosts A.B. Philbin Bowman and Kate O'Malley. And they kicked off the series with the second Earl of Inchiquin, William O'Brien. In 1674, Charles II appointed him governor of Tangiers, which he struggled to defend for 6 years. As historian John Gibney will tell us, he didn't exactly do the empire proud.
A couple of curious things about it were that it became a kind of political hot potato in British circles because it was seen as a potential hotbed of Catholicism. You would have had quite a lot of Irish troops over there. Now, in terms of Inchiquin's role, when he was relieved of his position in 1680, he apparently left it in a very poor conditions. Its defences were pretty poor. He apparently had a very authoritarian regime over his troops. Charles II was sufficiently unimpressed by Inchiquin's tenure in Tangier that when he came back he refused to let Inchiquin kiss his hand as a gesture of tribute, though Inchiquin apparently mollified the king by the gift of two ostriches to kind of I suppose sweet as one does.
Look what I brought you back from, you know, duty free.
But it wasn't the most appealing thing. Like the guy who succeeded him, the Earl of Ossory, another Irish noble who never actually got over to Tangier because he died in 1680, apparently on his deathbed he was supposedly raving that the king could have sent him to hell as easily as Tangier. It's what you might call a hardship posting. The high hopes for Tangiers, it came to be seen as this kind of strange place filled with dissolute, idle, drunken soldiers. But it wasn't a viable colonial outpost and was abandoned in 1684 fairly willingly.
But it's interesting you mentioned that he displayed, I think the quote was, he displayed little military capacity in his role in Tangier. And yet, his reward is, off you go and take care of Jamaica.
Because he was appointed by another king, William III, a.k.a. William of Orange.
There was a transition from a Catholic monarchy to a Protestant monarchy. Now, this had massive implications in Ireland. And Inchiquin, in the late 1680s, had taken the Williamite side. Now, that hadn't actually worked out very well for him because he'd had to abscond from Ireland. And the estates that his family had obtained in the 1660s were stripped away by the Jacobite Parliament of 1689 in Ireland, though, you know, they would have got them back eventually. But he had been loyal to an incoming regime. And it might just have been as simple as that. He had taken the right side in the conflict. He had backed the winner, so to speak. And it's probably no coincidence then that soon after that he became the governor of Jamaica, yeah, which was a fairly big deal and becoming an even bigger deal at this very, very time.
Oh, the changing fortunes of politics from Irish imperial lives. Now, we did promise you the answer.
Is this all male?
It's all male. Oh, no. No, Myla, no.
Well, everybody's been talking about this as if it were.
Pardon me?
Everybody has been speaking of this so far as if it were.
Oh, no, yeah, they are, but they're all wrong.
Oh.
Yes.
So it's mixed it, company.
It's mixed about. Company we're talking about, yeah.
A ladies' club.
A ladies' club?
No. Well, we're here, aren't we?
Yeah. And there are 9 questions gone.
It's not some kind of a jet set or something like that.
Not at all, no. No. This was there long before the jet set, I can tell you. Well, and long before the ladies' clubs, too.
Would it be like something like a courting couple?
Oh, the glory days. And we'll sneak this bit in for the week that's in it.
Election 2024. How does it begin? Britain, as we know, the 5th largest economy in the world. Well, 6th largest economy since it was passed out by India because of Brexit. But don't talk about that. It's Brexit. It's perfectly normal. Just imagine an Irish family gathering at a communion where, like, your drunk auntie casually mentions that she once saw Dahi O'Shea naked. And then the whole day is overshadowed by that one thing. But everyone pretends you're not thinking at all of Dahi's dingles, even while you're spearing a Super Quinn cocktail sausage. That is basically Brexit in the context of this British general election. Just don't mention the thing at all.
Oh, that is good. Back in a bit. Welcome back. We've all done it. Snotty tears in the bulb. Snivelling sobs in the work cubicle. Red eyes like sirens. Oh no, it's just my contact lenses playing up. But for a man to weep with frustration and disappointment on the hallowed football grounds, well, that's worthy of an item or two. The man in question, Ronaldo. His penalty saved in Portugal's match against Slovenia in the Euros. Cue those tears. Irresponsible as captain, said some, or a welcome show of emotion in a macho world. Here's the Darcy talking to psychoanalyst and therapist Ray O'Neill.
It is an incredibly gorgeous thing if men cry, because it sends such a powerful message to all the people in their lives that they are emotional and they're human. But of course, as men, we're raised not to cry.
Is that not changing, Ray O'Neill?
I'm doing my best, Ray. I'm doing my best to change it, sure. But yes, it is changing, and that's a great thing. I mean, you and I grew up with parents and grandparents that were afraid to cry and picked up those messages that men can't cry. And we are changing that and absolutely passing that message on to the future generation. But again, isn't it interesting, like whatever about the personality of Ronaldo in this, kind of like that it's a discussion point in 2024 that a man is overwhelmed by emotion and expresses it with tears.
And as it happens, O'Neill's own tears were prompted by a sporting moment.
When did you, or do you cry regularly, or was it a big thing when you cried first, or?
It was definitely, I mean, the irony of, like, the first time I really, really cried was actually at a penalty shootout in 2002 when Ireland went out of the World Cup in what was already an emotional experience for every Irish person. And I remember just being overwhelmed with the emotion of having done so well that the kind of the party was over. But I remember afterwards kind of going, why is it I'm crying at this? Like, there's 101 other things I probably could cry about. But this is the power of sport. It's one of the few places where men have permission to be emotional.
That was against Spain. It was a Sunday afternoon.
That was against Spain.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. And I'm wondering about pent up tears, because maybe, as you say, you had 100 other things you should be crying about, but it was sport that allowed you to cry.
People often, you know, at a funeral, the people who are most closely affected, who are friends or loved of the person who has passed, tend to be so caught up in it. It's the other people at a funeral that tend to cry, even though they may not know the person who's passed so well. Funerals are important rituals because they give a public space for tears and grief to fall.
And that ideas that tears are just not on can be hardwired into much of our culture and has often been handed down.
Did you ever see your dad cry?
He's probably listening, Ray. But of course I saw my dad cry. And it was probably later in life, and it was particularly around when he lost my mum.
Right.
And I know he was really, I hope it's okay saying this, I know he really struggled on so many levels. Not least of all, I remember him saying, I should be stronger for you all. And I remember saying to him, Dad, there is such a gift in you opening up an emotional space, because if you were not to cry, we'd wonder what was going on and we wouldn't be able to cry, myself, my sister and my brothers.
Now, you work as a therapist and people are coming in and they're going through tough times. That's the reason they're there. I would imagine you see a lot of tears in your work.
I do indeed see a lot of tears. And honestly, sometimes the hardest tears of all to feel in the therapy room are the tears that won't fall.
Right.
The tears that are afraid, that are ashamed of showing themselves. And you see that particularly with men.
From The D'Arcy Show. With Brendan at the weekend, actor Liz Carr. Now, you might know her from Silent Witness. She plays Carissa Mullery. But she is also a disability activist. And she talked about a whole host of things. It was an interesting interview, including bearing the mantle of brave.
I mean, people who are visibly disabled will often anecdotally talk about even strangers on the street coming up to you and saying, gosh, you know, I think you're amazing. But honestly, if I was like you, I don't think I'd go on. I'd rather be dead. And people aren't being mean. They truly mean that. They're meaning it as a compliment, actually. Gosh, you know, you're doing incredibly. But honestly, you know, I do think it's not meant with malice.
So you're so brave, is it?
Yes. I mean, I am, Brendan. Let's say that. I'm teasing. Yeah. But it is that. Yeah. Always, it is that, yeah. Or inspirational.
Yes.
Incredibly inspirational, because I managed to get up in the morning and on a Sunday and take a phone call with you. You know, I'm incredibly brave.
And to be pitied, Liz. To be pitied, but inspirational.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I think there's an awful lot of there, but for the grace of God. Like, I don't have to, you know, you deal with that and you do it, because I tell you, if I was in your state,
Yeah,
I couldn't do it. And, you know, I'm also not surprised.
Do people not like to even look at you or have you around sometimes? That there, but for the grace of God, does it make them uncomfortable sometimes, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That, I mean, you really got it. I mean, these are, you know, really difficult things to talk about. But I think, you know, I think for a long time, that's why we haven't even been on TV. Because who wants to see those different looking bodies and those different depressing lives that we'd rather not think about? I talk sometimes about how I'm two things, because I'm on TV. If you know me from TV, then I've got a profile. But if you don't know me and you just see me in the street, then I'm just this little disabled woman who can easily be ignored.
Oh, at your pearl, I suspect. Actor Liz Carr with Brendan. A really interesting discussion. Now, on Liveline yesterday, just a little bit of polyamory for the weekend. Here is Emer, married to David.
And you go back, we were saying 36 years now, is it?
Yes, we met in London in 1988. When I finished college, I went over there to get more of a wide variety of culinary skills. And we worked together in different departments in a big hospitality facility. So that's how we met.
They have three grown-up kids. Emer's in her early 50s and all her life very supportive of the LGBTQIA+ community.
So off I went and volunteered for Pride, and I was the volunteer coordinator for Pride for about 8 or 10 years. And that's how I met my now girlfriend.
Okay.
Well now, what exactly had happened?
The penny dropped, as you say. And you decided you wanted to act on it, but you are married.
Absolutely. So I sat my lovely husband down, because we always believed that, you know, communication is the only way of fixing things. You know, so I sat down and I said, look, I think I'm really beginning to find women attractive as well. And I mean, initially, to be fair to him, he was kind of, oh my God, is she breaking up with me? And once that worry was immediately quashed. There was no way, I absolutely no chance that I would ever break up with him. He's the most wonderful man in the world. But I said to him, I really want to try and maybe think about exploring this. You know, how would you feel if I went on a few dates with women? And he said, well, go and explore it, and but keep touching base and communicating and stuff like that. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I did keep saying, are you sure you're okay? Do you want to talk about it more? And he was like, no, I'm happy enough.
Incidentally, I mean, you say, you know, the only way you fix things is by communicating, but you can break things by communicating sometimes. Did you worry at all that it might go the other way, that conversation?
A little bit, yeah, for sure. But also I kind of thought, you know, we're not here for a very long time on this planet. And once I had realised in my own head and sort of had essentially come out to myself, which I know sounds very cliched, but once I'd kind of realised, yes, I absolutely do find women attractive, I couldn't then turn around and keep it to myself.
So where do you go then to meet somebody? Quite a particular circumstance. And for Emer, online was not so appealing.
Then I thought, do you know what? I will ring my best lesbian friend who ran Pride for years, which is how I knew her. And I said, the two of us, we'll meet up for a drink and we'll have a chat. And she'll show me the way of the lesbian. Show me how, because I was thinking to myself, who is going to want to date a brand new to the scene, like newly out woman in her 50s who has no intention of leaving her husband and has never even kissed a woman? Like, I mean, like, seriously, who's going to want that? So anyway, I texted my lovely friend Jilly and said, well, how about meeting up for a drink? First of all, I said, oh, by the way, I'm bisexual. And she said, great. I was wondering when you'd realise that. To be fair, the only person who was surprised was me.
And what was a friendship with Jilly turned into something more. Over 3 years later, they're all doing pretty well. But, to quote Katie,
I have so many questions.
Not least, where do you find the time?
The time is divided very well. Myself and Jilly meet up on a Wednesday night after work, maybe have a pizza, go for a walk, go to a movie, something like that. And then on Friday night, I meet her after work and I stay with her on Friday and Saturday. And then the rest of the week, I'm with David.
All very organised. Katie, though, more questions.
When you told David, your husband, and just to be clear, this is this is not a throuple. You know, David is in a relationship just with you, and you are the person who is in a relationship with these two people.
Yeah, I mean, some people classify it as a V-lationship. So I'm the bottom of the V and I'm in a relationship with the two of them. But they get on very well. They like each other a lot, but they're definitely not in a relationship with each other.
And do they see, that was my next question, do they see much of each other? Like what happens, like for Christmas, for instance, what do you do?
Yeah. So coming up to Christmas, we'll sort of say, what do we want to do? Last Christmas, my whole family went away to a hotel because we just didn't want the hassle of cooking. And I said to her, David said, do you want to invite Jilly as well? And I said it to her and she went, absolutely not. Your family are lovely, but in very small doses. We're quite a lot. There's a lot of singing around the piano and performance, and we're all performers and singers and actors. And that's like small doses.
Right.
We're a lot.
But David would have had no problem with of Jilly coming along, being part of that family Christmas.
No, not at all. And they kind of funnily, they tag team each other. So for my dad's 90th birthday party, David was there for the first half and then Jilly arrived later because she'd been working and she arrived in and he went over and he high-fived her and he said, you're in, bye. And he went home early. And then she kind of tagged in for the rest of the evening. Well, parties, our son graduated from university and there was a party in the house and they would both be there. And they're very similar to each other. A lot of people say that I have clearly got a type, which is English, dark-haired, dark-eyed, bespeckled, introverts, which is what both of them are.
And finally, as for pushback, not a huge amount.
And there was a little bit of blowback then from people online saying, you're not doing marriage correctly. And I was like, well, I'm doing marriage the way that is working for us. You can do marriage your way.
You do you.
Oh, it is all to play for from Liveline. Now, when was the last time you looked up and really looked at the clouds, aside from thinking, ooh, better get the wash back in? Well, for Gavin Preter Penny, clouds are magic. He is the author of Cloud Spotting for Beginners and a founding member of the Cloud Appreciation Society.
A lot of the philosophy of the Society of Cloud Spotting and the philosophy of this book is to be present and to enjoy the moment and to acknowledge the fact that the sky is something that brings people together. You know, nobody has a big argument about whether a sunrise is a beautiful thing. Yes. It's something we all agree on. And in a time of division, I think those things are worth celebrating.
And as he told Claire, from the fluffy to the cranky, there are clouds for all seasons.
Clouds like the cumulus cloud. That's the Simpsons cloud, you know, the cartoon cloud forms on a sunny day, the fair weather cloud. It's like the generic one, really. If you close your eyes, you're probably thinking of a cumulus. And then you might compare that. Another of the 10 main cloud types is the cirrus, the high, wispy ice crystals that are cascading from the upper reaches of the troposphere. They look like brush strokes across the blue, very contrasted to the cumulonimbus storm cloud, which reaches up maybe 8 miles into the sky, spreads out at the top in an enormous anvil shape, and produces thunder and lightning and sometimes hail. Mm-hmm. So those are the 10 main types you might have heard of.
And then, steady the children, the bad boy of clouds.
The nimbostratus is the one that gives all the other clouds a bad name. It's a sort of low, thick, wet blanket of the sky, and it produces rain or snow, but it's continuous. So the cloud hangs around a long time, like all the layer clouds do, because this is one of the layer clouds, and it hangs around a long time. And this one is one that produces quite a lot of precipitation, which can persist. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not the one that we appreciate most at the Cloud Appreciation Society, but it features in the book because, you know, if you were in an area or, you know, in an arid region of the world, the nimbostratus would you be your best friend.
Well, there you go.
But if you do see a cloud you don't like, don't worry. Chances are it'll change.
You look at the sky and you think, unless it's really wild, stormy weather, you look at the sky and you think, oh, it's all sort of stationary pretty much, the clouds. But then you only need to look away for a brief period and look back, maybe comparing them to something fixed, like a tree or something, and you'll see that they've moved. Same happens when you find a shape in the clouds. You know, you see a cloud that looks like some animal or something like that, and you tell your friend, and then by the time you both look up at it, it's sort of gone. So they are, you know, the most ephemeral of nature's displays. And for that reason, because they're only here so briefly, for some reason there's an opposite, and it makes the sky feel eternal.
Oh, a beautiful note on which to end. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I am not here next week, but talk to you the week after. I still dream.